Chapter 10, Examining the Examination. A qualifying examination is a statement as well as a test. It is a training institution's official declaration of the type of knowledge that is at the heart of knowing the subject. If enough students accept the official line that the examination tests the most important skills in the subject, then the training institution can maintain an intimidating atmosphere in which any dissatisfaction with the narrow focus required to prepare for the examination seems to reflect a possible lack of dedication to the subject. The institution can equate dedication to the subject, which students see as a legitimate qualification requirement, and dedication to a particular focus within the subject, which is the actual qualification requirement that the institution enforces through the examination. Students who don't automatically accept the examination's priorities have to go along with them and adjust the focus of their study anyway, if not because of the intimidating atmosphere of general acceptance of the exam's priority, then because of the threat of expulsion, which the atmosphere of acceptance works to legitimate. Because the qualifying examination carries the threat of expulsion, it compels the student's attention and dictates, at least, quote, temporarily, the student's orientation. Students judge much of what they do in part on its usefulness as preparation for the looming assessment. Under the threat of expulsion, any independent notion of what constitutes learning the subject dissolves into studying for the test. And students make this change quietly out of fear that any objection would be misinterpreted as a lack of dedication to learning the subject, legitimate justification for expulsion. Training institutions don't hide their narrowing of what counts as learning the subject. They often give the beginning graduate student a stack of tests from previous years. The student quickly learns that questions often repeat in similar or even identical form, making it even more imperative to study the exams. With official encouragement, then, learning the subject collapses into studying for the test, and studying for the test in turn quickly degenerates into studying the test itself. Because the qualifying examination plays a very serious role in the production and selection of professionals, being actively imposed as both a model and a measure, a model of the type of knowledge that the training institution deems of primary importance in the professional, and a measure that is usually accurate in picking individuals with the attitudes that the training institution favors. A close look at the examination itself should reveal most accurately what the system seeks in professionals. And I'm reading from Disciplined Minds, A Critical Look at Salaried Professionals and the Soul-Battering System That Shapes Their Lives by Jeff Schmidt, published in the year 2000. I'm reading from Chapter 10 and continuing on with the next subsection titled Imposing a Social Framework. Most people see the professional skill in and of itself as nonpartisan. It is no more applicable to work that perpetuates the social order than it is to work that challenges it. Even most leftists think of such skill as politically neutral, though widely misapplied. But does the technical skill that makes the newly graduated professional so well suited to fill a slot in the corporate government complex, so well suited to serve the status quo in an institution of the status quo, really suit the individual equally well to work for social change? A close look here at the process by which an individual is certified as an employable technical expert will reveal that it is impossible to separate the required skills from the political context in which they are used in the workplace. The skills required for certification as a professional reflect the political situation in which the employer's need for professional workers arises. The professional skills themselves are indeed partisan. because the practices and attitude that make professionals valuable workers for furthering the goals of the hierarchies that employ them are incompatible with the critical skills and independent thinking that would be required to challenge those goals and hierarchies. The student's level of enthusiasm for the test preparation work is of vital importance. It seals the student's future, because to be passed on the test and allowed to have a career in the field, a student must study with great intensity. The degree to which a student is able to maintain necessary protracted concentration on the test preparation problems reflects the student's feelings of interest. A student is not automatically interested in a set of problems just because the problems are in his or her field of study. For example, many students who are very interested in a subject and who put in much time in a dedicated way learning it are quite unenthusiastic about studying qualifying examination problems in the subject. Nick, the student who refused to study the old test problems, and this was discussed in our last chapter last week, worked day and night on problems from the books he studied. They're very good problems, although they may not help in passing the qualifying exam, he told me. Nick's behavior was just an extreme case of a common phenomenon, which one can understand only by recognizing that all problems signify human activity, and that students react consciously or unconsciously to the particular activity that the problems connote. A student's interest in a set of problems depends strongly on the student's reaction to the human activity associated with the problems, that is, on his comfort or discomfort with the social framework of the problems. The student's comfort with the social framework of the problems is in turn determined by the student's outlook. Any conflict between the student's outlook and the social framework of the examination causes a conscious or unconscious unease that sabotages the student's effort to prepare. The qualifying examination score, then, is a good measure of the student's willingness and ability to work within the examination's social framework. In this sense, it is a political score. What social framework does the qualifying examination impose? What do these problems say socially? The obvious place to look for the answer to this question is in the problems themselves. At first glance, however, it appears that the answer is not there, for all we see are isolated technical puzzles that seem to be value-free, that seem to stand alone above social activity. Ironically, it is the very fact that the problems are presented as pure technical puzzles, stripped of any obvious reference to social goals, that reveals the unstated social framework of the qualifying examination. For only one social framework can impose itself by remaining hidden, and perpetuate itself better that way than by being stated openly, the social framework of the status quo. By the social framework of the status quo, I mean work or other activity serving hierarchies, propagating the dominant ideology, and perpetuating the social structure. The qualifying examination reeks of the social framework of the status quo. This framework emanates from the test on three levels. The social framework of the status quo is announced by 1. The test as a whole, independent of the field the test serves. 2. The test as a collection of problems in a particular field, independent of the content of the questions. And 3. The structure of the test and the nature of the questions. The test as a whole. As a set of questions that form a qualifying examination, the test represents gatekeeping itself, and so imposes the social framework of gatekeeping. Prior to the role of the field in society, or the details of the individual questions, this booklet of problems represents passing or failing. It signifies the important social activity of selecting and rejecting people who want a career in a particular field. Hence, the competitive examination would not stand apart from social relations, even if its questions did. The examination is a socially innocent collection of technical puzzles only in the same narrow-minded sense that a gun is a socially innocent collection of metal parts. Because of the special role of the professions, especially the sciences, in the economy, the ability to do professional work has come to be closely associated with intelligence. As a result, qualifying tests, especially in the sciences, carry the additional social framework of intelligence testing. This causes disproportional anxiety in nonconformist students, who are likely to feel that their intelligence isn't detected fully by intelligence tests. And it causes disproportional anxiety in minority and female students who secretly fear that there may be some truth to the racist and sexist theories that they aren't as smart as whites or males. The fact that studies have proven such theories to be false doesn't completely eliminate the stereotype threat felt by these students. Students' recognition of the social framework imposed by the exam as a whole, particularly the making and breaking of careers, accounts for the fact that students whose main goal is a career in the subject assign greater importance to the qualification problems than do students who are primarily pursuing their curiosity in the subject or are interested in using the subject in non-traditional ways. The test is a collection of problems in a field. As a set of questions from a specific field, the qualifying examination symbolizes the problems that the field addresses in the real world and imposes the social framework in which these problems arise. What images are invoked by a collection of technical puzzles drawn from a particular field of work? If no other context is specified, isolated technical puzzles will situate themselves in their historical and contemporary context, where they will serve as reminders of the discipline's past and present role in society, and as reminders of the social structure and ideology in whose service such puzzles have arisen. In this way, isolated technical puzzles invoke images of the social hierarchy and the dominant ideology, the framework of the status quo. Even if the isolated technical puzzles did not invoke images of the work of the status quo, they would still impose that framework, because the paradigms of the field, in terms of which the technical puzzles and their solutions are framed, reflect the dominant values of the historical period. As a general rule, when isolated technical puzzles are imposed in a course or examination, by default, the framework of the status quo is imposed as well. What, for example, is the social framework of physics? The day-to-day work of the 50,000 to 100,000 physicists employed in the United States defines better than any other measure the role of physics in this society. Most of this work is problem-solving motivated directly by corporate and military interests, and much of the rest is connected indirectly to the same interests, as discussed in chapters 4 and 5. Only an extremely small fraction of physicists do work that is difficult to trace to these interests, and only a fraction of that fraction do work that challenges the dominant paradigms. The military-industrial social framework of physics touches the individual through the psychological environment or atmosphere that it fosters. An atmosphere is a prevailing attitude. At the heart of every atmosphere is a key issue, which is usually unstated, and a, quote, normal approach to the issue. This approach serves as an example of the normal way to deal with other issues that come up, and so defines an attitude. For example, the unstated issue at the heart of the tense atmosphere of the workplace staff meeting is the boss's authority, and deference is the normal approach. This puts strong pressure on each employee to maintain a subordinate attitude. The unstated issue at the heart of the macho atmosphere of the men's locker room is women, and domination is considered the normal approach. This puts strong pressure on each man to project a macho attitude. I give this second example because it is analogous to institutional physics, not only in form but also in content. The unstated issue at the heart of the military-industrial atmosphere of institutional physics is nature, and domination is the normal approach. This puts strong pressure on each scientific employee to adopt a military-industrial attitude. Playing with nature, getting to know nature, understanding nature, cooperating with nature. In the military-industrial atmosphere, such activities are not justified as ends in themselves, but only as a means to an end. And that end, in a word, is power. Power is the normal motivation within the military-industrial atmosphere. The normal physicist is one who, deep down, finds the work with nature exciting in large part because of its potential contribution to social power. This physicist works to dominate nature, either to contribute to military or economic power, or to contribute to the cultural power of physics. This down-to-business military-industrial atmosphere pervades all the institutions of physics. Thus, the typical basic physics research project at a university is carried out no more playfully and no more democratically than a military or industrial work project. The cultural power of physics is its influence on the way people view the world. What physicists say about the nature of the world is taken seriously, in large part because physics plays an important role in military and economic power, and in the way people work and live. The cultural power of physics is not simply a byproduct of its military and economic power, but is important to the maintenance of that power. The cultural power of physics lends legitimacy to the political actions of the institutions that use physics. Thus, for example, corporate and governmental spokespeople are taken seriously, even when they defy common sense with statements about the necessity of a new weapons system or the safety of radioactive waste. Despite the physicist's reputed lack of interest in things social, and despite the fact that many physicists do spend much of their time working alone on technical problems, it is normal for physicists in the military-industrial atmosphere to see their work as having great social import. The source of their feeling that their work is important is largely social. The past and potential importance of such work to the military and economic power, and to the way people view the world. The social importance of television, lasers, nuclear weapons, satellites, computers, men on the moon, quarks, black holes, and other physics-based technologies and notions hangs heavily in the air in the physics workplace, without being mentioned. In the military-industrial atmosphere, the physicist seeks to do socially significant work through non-social activity, and the prospect of success stirs a sense of power in the individual researcher. Even the epitome of the non-social worker, the nerd, is largely a socially motivated animal. The military, economic, and cultural power of physics leads people to view any set of physics problems with reverence. People's sense of the role of physics in society, its historical and contemporary service to technology, and its influence on the way people view the world, confers social status not only to those who work on physics problems, but also on the physics problems themselves. In this way, the isolated technical puzzles of the qualifying examination become a celebration of the field's social role, a reminder of its contribution to power. Not all students are equally comfortable in the military-industrial atmosphere carried by the problems of the qualifying examination. Some students are fans of the status quo. Others seek change and want to take no part in the status quo. The former will be quite comfortable in the atmosphere that surrounds the qualifying examination. The latter will feel like outsiders and may have trouble making the commitment necessary to pass the test. The structure of the test and the nature of the questions. The remaining sections of this chapter explain how, at this level, the qualifying examination serves the corporations and other employers. And I'm reading from Disciplined Minds, A Critical Look at Salaried Professionals and the Soul-Battering System That Shapes Their Lives by Jeff Schmidt. Continuing on with the next subsection of Chapter 10, Turning Tricks. Questions on qualifying examinations often penalize the creative student, while rewarding the student who mindlessly applies memorized tricks. To solve a typical math or science problem, you manipulate symbols in a sequence of steps, each of which takes you closer to the solution in a way that is apparent. However, it is possible to contrive problems whose solutions require a step that appears to be arbitrary or even counterproductive, the logic of that step becoming clear only later in the problem. This crucial step is the trick. The student who doesn't know in advance the trick required to solve a test problem is extremely unlikely to discover it while working on the problem, especially if no time is allotted for that purpose. And so problems based on tricks favor the memorizer over even the creative individual who has a good overall understanding of the subject. Some problems that can be solved without tricks are nevertheless made easier by tricks, as two examples from mathematics will illustrate. Because tricks often seem simple and obvious after they are explained, readers will better appreciate their nature by attempting the two problems now before reading the discussion below. Okay, well, this is a radio broadcast, and so you're not going to attempt these two problems now, but just to tell you what they are, the first one is to multiply 503 by 497. Well, the trick on that is use a calculator. This is the second one. The cube root of 64 is 4, because 4 times 4 times 4 is 64. What is a cube root of 1,728? So I will be paraphrasing much of this chapter from here on in so as not to make it a series of math problems. And Jeff Schmidt writes, problems that are made easier by tricks can be put into two groups. The first, represented by the first problem, which was the multiplication question, are problems simplified by tricks that are useful in many situations. Okay, Schmidt then explains the mathematical trick. If you want to know that, get hold of the book. The second group, exemplified by problem 2, are problems made easier by tricks that are useful in essentially just one problem. For example, to solve the cube root problem above, you can simply recognize 1728 as the number of cubic inches in a cubic foot, which is 12 inches by 12 inches by 12 inches, so the answer is 12. In either case, the tricks are optional. You can do the multiplication the long way and the cube root by trial and error. However, with a slight change, say a stringent time limit on the problems, the tricks become mandatory. Under this condition, the questions would still look like tests of arithmetic skills, but they would really be disguised tests of memory and the ability to psych out the questions. One often finds that a qualifying examination problem is impossible to solve without a special trick that is good only for that one problem. This kind of problem is usually constructed by starting with the trick and working backwards. The student who attacks such a problem with creativity, with an understanding of the subject, with the insight and with the standard tricks of the trade gets absolutely nowhere. The special trick is the only approach to the problem that works. The unwitting student who uses the wrong approach, as logical as that approach may be, and as effective as that approach may be in general, sinks deeper and deeper into increasingly complicated calculations, a frustrating mess, as it is often called, in an ultimately futile effort to get an answer. Because only the special trick works, only the student who has seen the problem before and memorized it can solve it. And because the student's creativity, understanding, insight, and experience do not lead to the trick, they contribute nothing to the student's score. Students are eager to learn the standard tricks of the trade for the field they are preparing to enter. A symbol manipulation routine that is good for only one problem will be part of this standard bag of tricks only if the problem is particularly important in the field. Otherwise, the routine will remain just another obscure entry in the reference books. Qualifying examination problems that require special tricks are not likely to be particularly important problems in the field because, like the cube root problem above, they are typically written around the tricks rather than around something important in the field. Hence, even the student who knows the standard tricks used by people working in the field cannot necessarily solve the qualifying examination problems that are based on obscure tricks. What is the aim of examination problems that reward the memorization, quick recall, and mechanical application of obscure symbol manipulation routines? Problems that are disguised requests to give performances of memorized, obscure routines clearly do not test the student's creativity, understanding, insight, or knowledge of the standard tricks of the trade. However, they do an excellent job of revealing whether the student is willing and able to do disciplined, alienated work on assigned problems. The assigned problems in this case being the test preparation problems, which include problems based on obscure tricks. The next few paragraphs discuss a test example from the physics qualifying examination regarding a dimensional harmonic oscillator and minimizing the energy for a triangular trial wave function. I'm going to skip this for those who are interested and able to comprehend what's even being discussed. Once again, I refer you to the book. Schmidt says that his argument does not depend upon understanding the details of this example, fortunately. And he goes on to say, it is unlikely that the people who use this problem on a qualifying examination expect the student to understand the quantum mechanics of sharp points in wave functions. Such quantum mechanics is obscure. Sharp points in wave functions do not occur in nature and do not play much of a role in the quantum mechanics curriculum. Anyone interested in simply measuring understanding would know better than to try to do so with this problem. Those who use this problem are not troubled by the fact that the typical student who gets credit for it probably does not really understand it, because a problem based on an obscure trick does not aim to test any such understanding. It aims to see if the student saw the problem, memorized it, while preparing for the examination. By revealing what the student did specifically to prepare for the examination, problems like this are an excellent measure of the student's willingness and ability to do disciplined, alienated work, the work that characterizes the preparation process. It is this willingness and ability, not knowledge of obscure tricks, that employers value most. Hence, the examination serves employers well, even if students quickly forget the obscure tricks that they must memorize to pass. It is understandable that such forgetting, which is a big worry of naive students, does not trouble professional training institutions or employers. The examination's emphasis on tricks is also part of its emphasis on speed, which favors a narrow-minded approach to problems, as I discuss in the next section. Standardized professional and pre-professional qualifying examinations, just like the faculty written tests that I have been discussing, also measures the student's willingness and ability to memorize the obscure and to psych out the test writer's intention. Consider the graduate record examination, a multiple-choice, verbal, quantitative, and analytical test given to college graduates seeking admission to programs for higher degrees, and the SAT, a mainly multiple-choice, verbal, and mathematical examination given to high school seniors who are seeking admission to the colleges of their choice. The verbal sections of these standardized tests feature rarely used words that the students typically encounter only on such tests and in test preparation books. The analogy, antonym, sentence completion, and reading comprehension questions that make up these verbal sections frequently offer more than one correct answer, only one of which gives credit. The same is true of questions on standardized science achievement tests used in admission decisions. As Albert Einstein's collaborator, Banesh Hoffman, shows in very simple language in his 1962 book, The Tyranny of Testing. The test instruction to pick the best answer means that the successful student is the one who either shares the tester's values or senses those values and adopts them for the examination. In general, students who simply look for the answer that they think is best don't do as well as those who look for the answer that they think the test makers favor. The unconscious ideological discipline that the latter approach represents is the pre-professional's first step toward the more developed ideological discipline that characterizes the professional. What about examination problems that do not require tricks? Do these problems, too, favor the memorizer over the individual whose primary tools are creativity and insight? The answer is yes. And the reason is the structure of the examination, in particular, its time pressure and the fragmentary nature of its problems. Work done under time pressure, be it craft work, service work, or intellectual work, is easy to spot, because people under time pressure don't simply do faster work, they do different work. It is of lower quality. Similarly, time pressure on an examination calls for and rewards a particular approach to problems. A timed examination favors students who are comfortable grinding out answers to problems without taking the time to develop insight into the situations described in the problems. Coming up with correct answers, which many students do by mechanically following similar test preparation problems that they have memorized, certainly does not imply understanding. Students who are comfortable only when they proceed on the basis of a comprehensive understanding, for example, physical science students who can work with confidence on a problem only by developing a feeling for the physical situation described in the problem, or biological science students who require a feeling for the organism, or social science students who cannot work without a feeling for the social situation. These students are at a disadvantage on a timed test. Such students gain insight into a problem by looking at special cases, by exploring interesting blind alleys, most of which turn out to be dead ends, by thinking about analogous situations and so on, all of which take valuable time from other problems on the test, resulting in lower scores. The qualifying examination favors students who take a conservative approach to problems, a narrow, mission-oriented approach based on the memorization of large numbers of test preparation problems. Disfavored are students who take a broad, explanatory approach based on developing a feeling for what is going on in the problems. The typical qualifying examination problem is actually only a fragment of a real problem. It is a technical part of a problem, or part of a technical part of a problem. That the social or even physical context in which the problem arises is rarely specified hurts some students and helps others. It saps the motivation of people for whom a problem is more than a puzzle, people for whom the solution to a problem is not the last line in a calculation, but is a statement about the situation in which the problem arises. That statement, of course, may be based on a calculation. These people, who want to explore the problem in its context, who get satisfaction from the impact of their work within the context, who often do their best work solving whole problems, where one must sort out relevant and irrelevant information in disorderly and confusing situations, these people are judged to be qualified or unqualified in their profession by their response to the problem fragments that the examination throws at them. For those who have adopted a rote, mechanistic approach, however, the narrowness of the assigned problems is not an obstacle. In fact, these people are often more comfortable with technical sub-problems than they are with the whole problems, where the context is a distraction or a source of anxiety. The qualifying examination's time restrictions and content restrictions both select for students who take a narrow approach to problems. Such restrictions make the examination much like a game, a high-stakes game in which it is imperative that you take a narrow approach if you want to be a serious contender, a game in which winning simply means that you are good at the narrow approach. These restrictions are similar to those under which most scientists and other professionals employed throughout the corporate government university complex do their assigned work. Hence, by rewarding the narrow approach, the seemingly objective examination puts the label most qualified on those who are best suited to serve employing institutions as narrow problem solvers. Time pressure and fragmented problems on a qualifying examination may appear to be testing for some politically transcendent speed skill or technical skill, but are actually testing for the narrow approach that institutions demand of their professional employees. In this sense, these skills themselves are political. The inextricable connection between skill and approach blows the cover of political neutrality on skill. I should emphasize that this kind of discussion about people who take a narrow-minded approach to problems is necessarily a discussion of professionals rather than non-professionals, because non-professionals are not trusted to extrapolate memorized solutions and apply them to new situations, even in a narrow-minded way. Non-professionals are expected, in essence, to approach problems with a closed mind, to follow carefully instructions that specify in detail how to handle routine problems, and to refer deviant problems to professional employees in the organization. And I'm reading from Disciplined Minds, A Critical Look at Salaried Professionals and the Soul-Battering System that Shapes Their Lives by Jeff Schmidt, published in the year 2000. Continuing on with the next subsection titled Boredom and Endurance. Examinations that span many hours or many days test something that shorter examinations do not. Endurance. Does this feature of qualifying examinations act neutrally? That is, does the endurance obstacle merely work to weed out those who are not genuinely interested in the subject? Or does it favor some types of interest in the subject over others? The answer to this question follows from a look at the potential mismatch between a student's interest in a profession and the profession's primary role in society. I have described how professional qualifying examinations are indirect in the way they test for the values that characterize the professional. Such examinations work largely through their structure and could be built around any aspect of the relevant professions and still end up selecting and rejecting more or less the same people. Nevertheless, the aspect emphasized on a qualifying examination is not arbitrary, and it serves to fine-tune the selection process. Although people within a profession work at a variety of jobs, each emphasizing a different set of skills, the profession's qualifying examination is often based on just one set of skills, the skills needed to do the type of work that the profession does as its main social function. This is the case for professions whose qualifying examinations are given after a couple of years of graduate school, as in the natural and social sciences, as well as for professions whose qualifying examinations are given just before admission to professional training, as in the medical professions. Today's typical physicist, for example, is employed to solve technical problems for industry or government, and so it is no surprise that the examination given to students wishing to enter physics emphasizes calculations, making it in part a test of the student's ability and, because of the commitment required, willingness to attack such problems. In fact, the examination consists almost exclusively of calculations, as if calculations are all there is to the subject. Even students who want to enter the field to pursue philosophical issues, to challenge the direction of the field, to demystify the field for the benefit of the general public, or simply as an end in and of itself to comprehend the field's insights into the world, even these students must, as a condition of admission, demonstrate through the calculational examination their ability to serve the military-industrial complex. The physics student who wants a career designing missile guidance systems is not required to know much about the philosophical foundations of physics. But the physics student who wants to pursue the philosophical issues is required to demonstrate employability by the aerospace industry. The field admits new members on this basis, not because the calculations are more basic than the philosophical foundations, and not for any other technical reason, but because the field is an integral part of a larger social and economic system. In general, the particular set of technical skills that you would need in order to help carry out a field's primary role in serving the system comes to define what people in the field speak of as the basic skills that everyone entering the field should have. A short examination would not be able to distinguish reliably between students who have these skills and students who are merely familiar with them. Students taking a qualifying examination are likely to have at least some interest in every facet of the profession they are seeking to enter, including some interest in the profession's primary function in the system. And the skills deriving from this interest might be enough to get them through a short test. It takes a long examination to separate the men from the boys, to use a repulsive metaphor made appropriate by the competitive male-gendered atmosphere in most fields. Students with a deviant interest in the subject have a common reaction to a protracted examination that is oriented not toward their interest in the field, but toward the field's main function in the system. It is the same reaction that they have to the months-long process of preparing for such a test. They find it a bore, an agonizing chore. In contrast, students who feel at home with the examination's orientation find the week-long test an exciting challenge. The marathon test is their game. Those with a deviant interest in the subject can play this game too because it is one aspect of their field, but the endurance test exposes their limited tolerance for it. As the ordeal drags on, hour after hour, day after day, the mind of the student with a deviant interest wanders. This student has an increasingly difficult time concentrating, and at some point during the examination is likely to resign mentally. Clearly, an endurance obstacle does not act neutrally in a test. On a typical qualifying examination, it acts to weed out students who are merely interested in their field's primary role in the system, and to select students who are comfortable with and committed to the kind of work involved in playing that role. And I'm reading from Disciplined Minds, a critical look at salaried professionals and the soul-battering system that shapes their lives by Jeff Schmidt. And continuing with the next subsection, technical details, naked formulas, and, quote, usefulness. When outsiders thumb through the pages of a qualifying examination, they often comment that the test looks very advanced. Indeed, the test is advanced, but not necessarily along the lines they have in mind. Some naive observers, knowing that they are looking at an examination for admission to a profession, assume they are looking at questions that test the candidate's ability to assess the underlying principles of the subject, to critique the foundations upon which the subject is built. What they are really looking at, however, are questions that are advanced down the road to narrow specialization, questions that avoid critical examination of the fundamentals through their burial in the technical details of specialized applications. The skills required for decoration with the mantle of qualification, the advanced degree, indicate clearly the kind of work the individual is being prepared to do. The ability to examine critically the ideological and social framework of the field is, of course, a prerequisite for anyone challenging the field's view of the world or role in the world. Those hired by corporations or the government to do research or development work, or by universities to do normal paradigm work, need no such critical ability, and in fact will work more harmoniously without it. The qualifying examination's narrow focus on technical detail makes it an appropriate test for these rank-and-file experts, who will be employed to work uncritically within an assigned ideological and social framework, and who will therefore live in a world where only technical detail remains. It's no surprise, then, that developing a critical view of the field is an extracurricular activity, one that the training institutions discourage not only through the test's exclusive focus on the technical details of specialized applications, but also through its coverage of a large number of such applications. One reason students are reluctant to look into critical views of their field is that the time devoted to do so would leave them that much less technically expert. As a result, the students who are the most likely to pass the test and get professional credentials are often the ones prepared to do little more than render technical service to employers within the given ideological and social framework. One common feature of the many characteristics of the qualifying examination discussed in this chapter is that they all place a higher value on unexamined production than on understanding. These characteristics of the exam include its emphasis on memorized tricks, a mechanistic approach, work under time pressure, problem fragments, endurance, confinement to technical detail, and comfort with the separation of theory and experiment. Another way the test shows its orientation toward uncritical production is by the type of answers it deems valid. Almost all questions on physics examinations, for example, are designed to have answers that are formulas rather than explanations or discussions of meaning or significance. The formula is seen not as a tool to help with an explanation, but as the answer. The supposition is that the formula answers, which are often approximations that bear little resemblance to more exact formula answers, say it all, and so students usually are not even asked to interpret them. That the formula, not the explanation or discussion of significance, is the final answer, reveals values embedded in the examination. Valued is the concise, instrumentalistic summary of nature, the naked formula, a recipe sufficient for manipulating nature, but sorely insufficient for understanding nature. Even something as simple as a weight hanging on a string illustrates the point. Why does the weight swing back and forth after you give it a push? What can you say about its motion in terms of forces, velocities, and accelerations? Is the acceleration ever horizontal? Where is it zero? Most physicists would have trouble answering these questions. Yet they can perform a mathematical derivation routine that yields, for example, an approximate formula for the time that the pendulum takes to swing back and forth. The qualification system's values, which reflect the larger system's need for people who will engage in unexamined production, tell students that by obtaining formula answers, they have done the most important work of the physicist. And so students are only slightly embarrassed when questions like those above expose their lack of feeling for what is going on. Their embarrassment is much greater when they forget a routine for deriving a formula. For simple and complex problems alike, it is very common for students to obtain the right answer somewhat mindlessly, without grasping what is going on, or even with a fundamental misunderstanding. On the very last line of an exam answer that gets 100% credit, one often sees a formula with a rectangle drawn around it. In the culture of science, the box says not only, "This is the answer," but also, "This is what is of value." Whether one is inclined to box a formula or an explanation or statement about meaning is a question of values. The examination announces its values and priorities for the subject by making the formula the goal and the end of the problem, the bottom line in every sense of the word. In this value system, anything that follows the formula is seen more as commentary than substance. It is no accident that the bottom line on questions used to select scientists today is the formula, the recipe that science gives to engineering. The formula answer is simply another way in which the values of a society dominated by a powerful military corporate university complex show up in questions that are supposedly, quote, pure science. Selecting new scientists with a test that places higher values on recipes than on explanations or discussions of meaning is one of the many ways in which university scientists serve the needs of employers. The examination's values help adjust students for employment in the military corporate university complex, where much of the work even dispenses with formula results and uses numerical computer methods to go directly to the most quantitative form of all, arrays of numbers. For students who seek to grasp the understanding of the world offered by the field, but not as a way of preparing to serve the technical needs of the military corporate university complex, the adjustment of priorities from explanations to uninterpreted formulas represents a greater loss than the final adjustment from formulas to numbers. Without developing an intuitive feeling for the subject, the scientist cannot critically examine the paradigms that he or she uses, does not have a sense of what the field can and cannot do, and is less able than the hobbyist to use the field independently outside of workplace assignments. Hence, the qualifying examination's priority on recipes over understanding, or equivalently, its use of recipes as the measure of understanding, produces scientists whose only real ability is to serve the system. The system protects itself by producing people with know-how rather than people with know-why. The system is set up to produce servants, not critics. And it succeeds at this in part by propagating a culture of science that is fundamentally uncritical. The uncritical nature of this culture is revealed clearly by the values of those who are in it, by the kind of activity that they feel is most worthwhile. In this culture, physicists who take care of technical details but who do not question the ideological and social framework in which they are working, or who come up with formulas or numbers but do not develop an intuitive feeling for the physics of the problems on which they are working, Such physicists do not see themselves as technical servants uncritically meeting the needs of the military corporate university complex, but simply as physicists doing what is useful. In this culture, the rare physicist who engages in critical examination of the field and its role in society is seen as doing work that is at best less useful and at worst not even a legitimate part of the field. Thus, at the University of California, Berkeley, physics professor Charles Schwartz was denied a pay step advance after he switched the focus of his research and publishing from theoretical atomic and elementary particle physics to the critical examination of the social role of physics. A university dean explained the denial to the chairman of the physics department in a letter marked strictly confidential. And the letter said, "I am sorry to tell you that the proposed merit increase for Charles L. Schwartz to Professor 3 effective July 1, 1976 has not been approved. Dr. Schwartz is a good undergraduate classroom teacher and a successful PhD director. Reviewers, other members of the physics faculty, and I do not, however, believe that his work since 1970 can be considered scholarship in physics. Although every department gives its faculty wide latitude in choosing an area for research, this latitude is not infinite. If Professor Schwartz were doing scholarly work in a field unrelated to physics, this work should not and could not be used as the basis for a merit increase in the physics department. His contributions in all other areas are sufficiently satisfactory that should he produce first-rate research in physics as he has done in the past, advancement would seem assured." The culture of science encourages students to feel a sense of accomplishment when they complete assignments, even when they do so uncritically and without developing an intuitive feeling for the work. After all, such work is useful. Indeed, uncritical, unintuitive work is useful to individual employers and to the system as a whole, because it gets the job done without challenging the ideology and social agenda that it advances. But for the same reason, it is not useful to those who want to make such a challenge, or even those who just want to have a say in the ideology or social role of their own work. An examination favors people who feel a sense of accomplishment when they do the type of work that it rewards. People who are comfortable with the established order feel a sense of accomplishment when they complete uncritical, unintuitive work that the order deems useful, and are therefore favored by the qualifying examination, whose emphasis on taking care of technical details with an unquestioned ideological and social framework and de-emphasis on explanations rewards an uncritical, unintuitive approach. The uncritical culture is powerful, so that even people who oppose the present order intellectually, if they haven't internalized their opposition, may too feel a sense of accomplishment when they serve the system well. Workers who are not critics, that is, workers who don't ask themselves whose social agenda a particular work assignment advances, and who thereby fail to determine for themselves whether the work is worthwhile and whether a personal sense of accomplishment is in order, are doomed to serve the system whose culture determines these things for them. Albert Einstein never took a physics qualifying examination. If he were going through professional training today, however, he would be judged at some point by such a test. One can imagine an examiner seating Einstein in a cubicle, handing him a set of questions about the technical details of specialized problems, looking at the clock and announcing, "You've got 2 hours, show us what you're worth." An Einstein would not stand out on such a test, but his score would be meaningful nonetheless. It would be a good measure of his ability to serve the military corporate university complex, that is, to do useful work, not his ability to look critically at the field's role in the world or view of the world. The system measures human beings and the field itself by their ability to serve the established order. And I'm reading from Disciplined Minds, A Critical Look at Salaried Professionals and the Soul-Battering System that Shapes Their Lives, by Jeff Schmidt, published in the year 2000. And continuing on to the concluding subsection of Chapter 10, the subsection is titled, The Elitist's Advantage. Qualifying examinations hold theory in higher regard than experiment, and thereby favor students who do the same. An examination is a statement as well as a measure, and those who agree with the values that a test proclaims have the advantage of feeling at home during the months of arduous study that lead up to it. In physics, qualifying examinations declare their higher regard for theoretical work over experimental work, both through their content and through their form. The simple fact that the test determines who is qualified to go on to work in the field concentrates on how to do things with theory, almost to the complete exclusion of how to do things with real materials, is a strong statement about what the examiners think is most important in the professional physicist. Also, the examination takes a primarily written form. Even the relatively short oral section is held in a classroom rather than a lab, and a material object is rarely brought in to serve as the object of discussion. A student's insight, creativity, and intuition regarding the nature of nature, derived from experiences in the garage, workshop, or lab, or simply the experience that follows from a general interest in working with physical objects, go almost completely undetected by the examination. The test is more sensitive to knowledge about the nature of models of nature, derived from textbook practice with the dominant paradigm, and from a general orientation toward theory. To those who feel that the hierarchy of social status associated with the theorist-experimenter division of labor is proper, it makes perfect sense that the test emphasizes that pure thought that stands above the grime of the laboratory. Students with such elitist beliefs are often happy never to have contact with the actual objects of the theory they are studying. These students naturally study the subject in just the way the examination presents it, and therefore end up having an advantage on the test. On the other hand, students who are less taken by the status of theory, or who simply seek a more complete knowledge of physics, will not see the examination's version of their subject as glamorous, because for them, work with symbols out of the context of work with things is simply dry and boring. These people, whose interest, development, skill, and very understanding of physics derive from their encounter with the interplay between experiment and theory, a totality that professional physicists have experienced less and less over the years, will be at a distinct disadvantage in trying to prepare for the qualifying examination. Thus, the qualification test favors those who support the hierarchical division of labor, those with elitist beliefs. The fact that a system of professional qualification favors elitists should come as no big surprise. After all, employers typically trust professionals to help maintain hierarchy in the workplace and, through their work, elsewhere in society. One result of a selection system that ranks theory higher than experiment, and that by implication accepts the separation of the two, is the creation of specialists who have little ability to deal with theory and experiment in an integrated or even connected manner. These people, and I have encountered many over the years, perform well on the tests but flounder or give answers that are embarrassingly unrealistic. When asked to explain one or another of the many physical phenomena that appear in everyday life, clearly, the division of labor is a problem not only for physicists but for physics as well. Other fields suffer from the same problem. We have seen in the chapter how the distinct lack of enthusiasm that many otherwise enthusiastic students show for qualifying examination problems is understandable in terms of the student's sensitivity to the examination's unstated social framework, that of the status quo. That framework is imposed by identification of the isolated technical puzzles, first with career tracking and intelligence testing, second with the field's past and present service to the system, and third with alienated and unsatisfying work performed under authoritarian social conditions. The qualifying examination favors those most willing and able to do work within the social framework of the status quo. Those comfortable with the status quo are the ones whose enthusiasm for performing intellectual labor is least likely to be dampened by a lack of knowledge of and control over the social goals of their work assignments. The ones least troubled by surrendering this key element of the creative control of their work to those who see and oversee the big picture. Similarly, those who favor the qualifying examination system often turn out to be the least critical of social hierarchy and the dominant ideology, that is, the least critical of existing power relationships and, therefore, the least progressive politically. The social framework imposed by the examination problems and by the rest of the qualification system maps out a domain of allowed activity that ultimately becomes the playpen of the non-radical credentialed expert and the cage of the individual working for progress in the social structure. To have any chance of success, the latter must step outside the confines of professional work.